Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president, CEO, and political observer Alan Chartok and Roundtable host Joe Donahue are joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing the most important issues of the week, giving you a chance to catch up, ponder, or reconsider. On Monday, December 14th, Alan and Joe welcomed UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies Jennifer Burns, political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, counterterrorism expert and best-selling author Malcolm Nance, and immunology and allergy specialist Dr. James Fagan.
Since we have the doctor for a short time here, we'll start with those stories having to do with the pandemic. Of course, the dual stories here continue to be, they have been for a long time, which is we are seeing some of the worst numbers we have ever seen. We are breaking records, unfortunate, horrible records, day after day after day. Yes, the past week was the deadliest week we have seen since this pandemic struck the United States of America. That, of course, is a story in and of itself. Meanwhile, we are, as of this very second, preparing for a vaccine. I believe right here in New York State, the first vaccine will be given in a short time, and that is the case throughout states in the country. So we have two tracks of discussion this morning when it comes to coronavirus. One, of course, is the continuing just toll that this pandemic is taking. And then, of course, as we get ready, and who has access to the vaccine and who immediately does not. So, Dr. Fagan, let us begin with you. You've been on our program now for several weeks, and last week, you know, told us that we're seeing some of the worst numbers. We now have seen numbers even worse than those. And from all accounts, this seems like it's going to get much worse before it gets any better. I'm wondering if you can sort of give us a sense of where we are right now when it comes of competing with the messages, yes, there's a vaccine out there, and making sure people still do what they need to do.
Well, we now are approaching, 17 million total cases in the United States and approaching around 300,000 deaths total in the United States. We're looking at about 3,000 deaths per day. And as we talked about last week, these numbers are all predictable. We knew that following Thanksgiving, there was going to be a surge, and there is. It usually is a week or two after, you know, a major event, and that's exactly what we're seeing. We now have over 100,000 patients hospitalized in the United States, which means that we're, you know, they're occupying about 10% of all of the hospital beds in this country. And so the medical infrastructure is really stressed to the point that, you know, there's real concern what's going to happen in a couple of weeks, because we're looking at Christmas, you know, in a week and a half, and, you know, what's going to happen after that. So things are really out of control in the United States with regard to this pandemic. Now, the good news, as you point out, is that, you know, thank goodness we now have a vaccine, and we're going to see today marks the day number one of vaccine administration. And so that, as we talked about last week, you know, is the light, the strong light at the end of a very long tunnel. It's going to take us a while, though, to get to the end of that tunnel, as we talked about. In order for the vaccine to be really effective, we have to establish what we call herd immunity, which means that about 70% of the population of the country will have to be immune to this virus. That's a lot of people to vaccinate, Joe. We're talking about, you know, we have 328 million people in this country. We're talking about 250 million people who would need to be vaccinated. So that's gonna take some time. You know, and I think that, you know, there are issues with regard to the logistics of this vaccine. You know, we're now, the one that's been approved, that has received emergency use authorization, is the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine, which is that messenger RNA vaccine. you know, which we talked about. And I think this is extremely effective, and from all of the data that's been generated, it appears to be very, very safe. And so I'm certainly hopeful that the large percentage of American public will buy into this. I think that at last count, what I saw was around 60 to 70% of people said that they would take this vaccine, which would be great, because if we can get 70% to take it, then we will reach herd immunity. But that's going to take, you know, some time to vaccinate all of those individuals. So we have a ways to go.
So, Jim, I have a question for you. I know that when you first came on, you described how you would get into the garage next to your house and take your clothes off and throw them into the, because you've been dealing with patients, COVID patients. Are you going to get the shot? I would hope so.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, the question, absolutely. I mean, I think that whenever I can, whenever it's offered, I will get it. I think the individuals who need to be vaccinated first and foremost are those medical personnel, those staff who work out of emergency rooms and urgent care centers, who are really, you know, at the front line of this battle against COVID-19. I think those and the entire staff of the emergency facilities really should be vaccinated, and then go down the line in terms of other medical professionals. Absolutely, I would encourage everybody to get vaccinated as soon as it becomes available to them.
I tell this story, but not to be, not to try to gain sympathy on any side, but I just find it an interesting in the times of which we live and the times that this administration have created. But it came out yesterday that the White House was going to get first crack at this vaccine, and the internet blew up. And then they said, okay, well, we're not going to, the president tweeted, well, we're not going to take it. We're not going to take it. And then the internet blew up again and said, why don't you trust it? So I'm just one. So, I mean, this is okay, but that's the environment that was created through this whole thing. And it continues. That's a small, that's a microcosm of what we're dealing with, of trying to say to increase that number that you mentioned of 60% of the people who say that they'll take it to up that to a higher degree.
Well, there are a number of past presidents who said that they would take this vaccine publicly. I know that Joe Biden said that he would take this publicly, and I think it would be a good example if Donald Trump publicly got vaccinated. Even though he had the infection, we are recommending that even those individuals who were infected with COVID-19 get vaccinated against this, and I can explain the reasons for that. But it's indicated that everybody get vaccinated, and I think that public confidence in the vaccine is critically important, and I think that it would help to see public officials get vaccinated so that to increase the confidence that this is safe and it's an effective vaccine. I think that's going to be really, really, really important in order to get everyone to buy into this.
A few letters have come in that I find frustrating, because people are saying, I have absolutely no intention whatsoever of getting the vaccination, which is, of course, interesting, but they're not taking it the next step and telling us why. I would be interested in why. Of course, what we've been told from people who do say that they're not taking it is because they don't trust it, because it was done so fast. We have another letter from a listener who says 9 months seems super fast for a vaccine. If it fails and has adverse effects not seen in clinical trials, what happens then? How do we answer those questions?
Well, I think that, again, I think public confidence in vaccine safety and efficacy is critical. We've all heard about Operation Warp Speed, which is, a partnership with the Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Defense and the private sector, and Operation Warp Speed is pushed to make this vaccine available in record time. And that, I think, has raised some concerns about maybe the standards for safety and efficacy were relaxed a little bit, but I don't think that's the case, Joe. I think the FDA has absolutely reaffirmed that vaccine decisions were based on scientific data and that there were really no compromises with respect to evidence-based standards. The safety issues were subjected to the same time-tested processes for evaluating and regulating vaccines that have been in place at the FDA and the CDC for many years. The emergency use approval was approved by the Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research, and the center is directed by the Dr. Peter Marks, whose intelligence and integrity I have absolute total confidence in, and I know that they made the right decision. And I think that the whole process was, transparent, and I think legitimate in terms of the approval procedure. But the fact that that this vaccine developed in record time does not mean that there were compromises in safety or efficacy. It just means that the full attention of many, many pharmaceutical companies and the federal government and the NIH and the CIA, everyone was focused on this. It reminds me of what happened during the early days of HIV. I think that it's an example of how amazingly capable we are of accelerating certain processes without compromising safety or efficacy. And I think that we should have full confidence in this vaccine. Are there adverse reactions? I mean, and I think that we should sort of talk about those as well. If you looked up the side effect of a baby aspirin, you probably would have second thoughts about taking it. But in terms of vaccine, there are adverse reactions. A vaccine adverse reaction is an untoward effect caused by a vaccine that is extraneous to the vaccine's primary purpose, which is producing immunity. Vaccine adverse reactions, there are three basic types of adverse reactions. There's local, systemic, and allergic reactions. Local reactions are the least severe and the most frequent, and allergic reactions are the most severe and the least frequent. Local reactions occur, they include things like, pain, swelling, and redness at the injection site. And these are very, very common. In fact, I tell people that's actually a good sign because it means that the vaccine is actually working. The immune, it's generating an immune response. Local reactions are most common with inactivated vaccines that contain adjuvants, which are, chemicals that help create a stronger immune response. And then there are, systemic adverse reactions are more generalized, include, fever and malaise and muscle aches and pains and headaches and loss of appetite. And they can be caused by the vaccine, or sometimes they're caused by things completely unrelated to the vaccine, like a concurrent viral infection. But we see systemic reactions commonly with live attenuated vaccines. By the way, the COVID-19 vaccine is not a live attenuated vaccine, so it's unlikely that you're going to probably have a systemic reaction.
Alan.
I have a question for you, Jim, if it's okay.
Yeah.
I desperately want to take that vaccine. I prefer not to die. And so it's really quite simple. I want to take it. However, there is an intervening variable, as we social scientists sometimes say, and that is that once I had an allergic reaction to a bee sting, and now we're told those with allergies might want to hold back. Not me, because, if I have an allergic reaction, we have emergency rooms. We have people who can handle it. So what do I do, lie?
No, you don't lie. And let me talk a little bit about the allergic reaction. Okay. The allergic reaction, that's the third type. There's the local reaction, systemic reaction, and then allergic reaction to the vaccine is the third type of adverse vaccine events. And these reactions, do tend to be severe. Some of them are deemed anaphylactic, which means they can be life-threatening. The allergic reaction may be triggered by the vaccine antigen, which is the immunizing component of the vaccine, or some other vaccine component, such as cell culture material, stabilizer, preservative, or whatever else is in there. And these type of allergic reactions, let me just tell you, are exceedingly rare, occurring at a rate of less than 1 in 500,000 doses. Anaphylactic reactions are the most severe type of allergic reactions. And as I said, they can be life-threatening. Typically, they will occur within minutes to an hour or so after receiving the vaccine. Much more likely to occur very shortly after the vaccine is administered. And, you know, the signs and symptoms of anaphylaxis would be swelling of the lips, the tongue, the throat, difficulty swallowing, difficulty breathing, coughing, wheezing, you know, hives, a drop in blood pressure, things like, you know, and obviously this is, you know, this is very serious. But this is exceedingly, exceedingly rare. In my entire career, I think I've seen one or two kids who had an allergic type of reaction to a vaccine. The local reactions are common. The systemic reactions are common, but the allergic reactions are not common. But let me make a comment about, you know, the allergy. First of all, I was astounded by the fact that in the combined phase 3 clinical trial of Pfizer and Moderna, which included 74,000 people, there was not a single case of an allergic reaction to the vaccine. It was astounding to me that on day one of administration of this vaccine in the UK, two individuals reportedly developed an allergic reaction. Now, you know, I haven't seen the data on that, and you know, was this truly an allergic reaction? I would love to see exactly what happened to these individuals. But let me just make one general comment, and I think this is critically important. Allergy is not generic. Being allergic to peanuts or insect venom or some other food or a medication or penicillin, that has absolutely nothing to do with allergy to a vaccine. Nothing at all. And, you know, I will say this. I disagree with the statement that people who have a history of having had anaphylaxis to a food or to a medication are at risk for a severe reaction to the vaccine. It doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. There are things in the vaccine, in the COVID-19 vaccine, which are added as sort of vaccine stabilizers, which may have been responsible for the reaction that those two Brits had to the vaccine. There's something like called polyethylene glycol, which is in that COVID-19 vaccine, and there are rare individuals who may be allergic to that. And if they are, and they get that through the vaccine, they may have a reaction. But again, this is exceedingly rare. I mean, we're talking about probably closer to 1 in a million people who will have an allergic type of reaction. So, you know, there is absolutely, you should have absolutely zero concern, in my view, to take that COVID-19 vaccine because you have another type of allergy.
You know, well, I'm taking it. Well, Jim, I'm going to take it if they'll give it to me. I'm just worried that I go in there, and if I say, you know, I once got stung by a bee and I had an anaphylactic reaction, that they won't give it to me. That's why I asked you whether I should lie, because I would rather have a reaction than face death.
Yeah. By the way, when you say you had an anaphylactic reaction to insect venom, you had to be rushed to the hospital?
I went to the emergency room.
Did they give you epinephrine?
They did.
Okay, well, then you must have had a severe reaction. But
I had the symptoms you talked about. You know, there were hives and stuff like that. It wasn't to the point where I was in, you know, where I was dying or anything.
The reason I'm asking you those questions is because there's a lot of misunderstanding about what constitutes a severe allergic reaction. If you just had generalized hives, for example, that would not be an anaphylactic reaction. That would not be an indication to receive epinephrine. So, you know, the diagnosis of anaphylaxis really includes things like significant respiratory difficulty, you know, drop in blood pressure, swelling of the throat. So those are the things that we would really worry about.
I didn't have those. Yeah.
Yeah. So you probably did not have an anaphylactic reaction to
infection. I probably used the word wrong.
But that's why my advice to you would be, don't use the word anaphylaxis. Yeah, so you have an insect venom allergy. That's got nothing to do with anything in terms of raising the likelihood that you would have an adverse reaction to the vaccine. And again, I think this is really important. I took issue with the general statement that anyone with a history of severe allergy should not receive this vaccine. I think that's incorrect. Again, allergy is not generic. You know, you're being allergic and severely allergic to things like insect venom or certain foods or medications has no bearing on your likelihood to have a severe allergic reaction to this vaccine. You would have to be allergic to a component of the vaccine. There is no antibiotic in this vaccine. You know, there certainly is no insect venom in this vaccine. So there would be absolutely no reason why you would expect to have an adverse reaction. And I think that that's important. I would hope that individuals who had a history of anaphylaxis, I would hope that they would not be excluded from this vaccine. In my view, that would be a big mistake.
All right. We have a lot of letters from listeners. Let's get to as many as we possibly can here in the few minutes that we have with Dr. Fagan. From Jim to another Jim, if one spouse takes vaccine and the other doesn't, is either one put at risk?
Well, certainly if one spouse is vaccinated, the other spouse would not be at risk for anything. In fact, the risk would be somewhat attenuated because you would not expect the spouse who was vaccinated to come down with COVID-19. One of the issues is, can you still transmit, if you're vaccinated, can you still transmit, an infection? And the honest answer is we don't know yet. I mean, it's a novel vaccine, but I've said this before on the show, in my personal view, I think that's going to be very, very unlikely. The question is, does the vaccine prevent infection with COVID-19, or are these vaccines designed to reduce the severity of infection and the risk of complications? The vaccine clinical trials were never designed to determine whether vaccinated people who get infected can still be contagious. And so we still have to wait and see about this. But I think it's very likely that the vaccine will prevent infection and therefore will prevent the ability of the person who is vaccinated to transmit the disease to anyone. But let me just, another comment on that is that I think that it is critically important that all of us continue to maintain certain things. We should continue wearing masks. We should continue social distancing. We should continue hand hygiene, even after being vaccinated, because what we don't want is a lot of people walking around not wearing masks, not doing social distancing because they think, they're safe because they have the vaccine. I think that it is in the public interest for all of us to continue to do these things, which will really keep a lid on this infection until we're able to reach that herd immunity, which means 70% are vaccinated. So long-winded answer to that question, but my recommendation would be that if your spouse is vaccinated, you should follow their lead.
Sounds like a good plan always. Adam says, what are the differences between the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines? Are they all pretty much the same?
Yeah, both the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines are messenger RNA vaccines. So they are both, and these are unique vaccines. They've never been used before. I think they're brilliant in the way that they were developed. There's every reason to believe they're extraordinarily effective and very, very, very safe. The difference between the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine has to do with the way that the messenger RNA is encapsulated. What Moderna did is they put this lipid molecule sort of on top of the vaccine, which makes it less likely to decompose if it's not in very, very cold temperatures. The problem with the Pfizer vaccine is that it requires storage of minus 70 degrees Celsius, which means that it requires special refrigeration units. The Moderna vaccine does not require that. You can store the vaccine in regular refrigerators, so and that's a big difference. In terms of the immune response, it's probably going to be I would say it's probably going to be the same. Both are have been reported to be 95% effective. So I think it makes no difference whether you get the Moderna or the Pfizer. Moderna hasn't been authorized yet. Just the Pfizer has received authorization from the EUA. But I have reason to believe Moderna will also receive emergency use authorization. What you shouldn't do, however, is you should get the second dose. Remember that you did both the Moderna and the Pfizer require two doses. For the Pfizer, it's 3 weeks after the first one. For Moderna, I think it's 4 weeks after the first one. You can't mix and match. That you can't do. If you got the Pfizer vaccine for the first vaccine, you have to get the Pfizer vaccine for the second vaccine.
Dr. James Fagan on the Roundtable Panel on Monday, December 14th. This is Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm producer Sarah LaDuke. Please note as you listen, any given topic's details and facts may have changed and evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. We'll be back with more after this. Welcome back to Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm producer Sarah LaDuke. On Tuesday, December 15th, Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue caught up with investigative journalist and UAlbany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo, The Empire Report's J.P. Miller, and former associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain.
So the question is, should it be required? That is the question that is being asked. There's an interesting piece in the New York Times this morning. Should companies require employees to take the vaccine? Depending on the poll you read, 40 to 50% of Americans say they will not get a coronavirus vaccine when it first becomes available to them. In a survey of firefighters in New York City who are essential workers at high risk of infection, 55% said they do not intend to take a vaccine if offered by their departments. The possibility that large swaths of the population may refuse or simply delay getting vaccinated presents a perilous challenge to the health of the nation and the economy. Widespread coronavirus vaccinations are not only the best way to keep the people from dying, they will also help revive business and the economy. There is
absolutely.
So three quarters of this nation, unless three quarters of the nation is vaccinated, the engine of the economy will not jumpstart the way so many are hoping. The debates about health restrictions and economic stimulus plans would continue. If individuals are left to make the vaccine decision by themselves, a 75% compliance rate may be unattainable. That's why business leaders are so uniquely positioned. They can tell employees that they may only return to the workplace if they get vaccinated. This could be made compulsory for workers everywhere, from factories to offices and beyond. Mandating vaccines would be especially important to help protect workers in minority and lower socioeconomic communities that have been hardest hit in the pandemic. According to a Pew Research poll, only 42% of Black Americans intend to get vaccinated. Beyond social welfare, there's a persuasive argument that a vaccination mandate could be considered a workplace benefit. If employees knew that everyone around them is vaccinated, they would feel more comfortable working there. And it would create a compelling competitive advantage. A service like Uber, for example, would be more attractive to customers if the company said that all of its drivers were vaccinated. The same could be said for Walmart, Starbucks, or any store or restaurant. So,
what about an airplane?
Well, if you're going to get in it, you have to say that you've been vaccinated.
Right.
You have to prove you've been vaccinated.
Right. So that's the question. Should companies do this? Panel.
What do you think the Supreme Court will say when that clear case comes to the Supreme Court?
Well, it's already been through the courts, and companies can compel their employees to do it. And that has been upheld. I mean, obviously, you can challenge previous court rulings and, you right. know, all that. But if you're in healthcare or if you're in public safety, wouldn't you want to compel them? But my opinion is that rather than compel people to do it, except maybe in frontline healthcare delivery, you use a full throttle public service campaign to push it. You know, get celebrities, sure. get LeBron James, Dolly Parton, George Clooney, Warren Buffett, and everybody else to, you know, Barack Obama to walk up and get their vaccine. And you know, it just seems so obvious that if you ran a business, if you ran a gym or you ran a hairstyle business, and you said all of our employees are vaccinated and protected, and you may not come here unless you are, people would go there because they know it'd be safe, or they'd get on a plane because they know it'd be safe if people had to do it. Don't you think that the public tide is going to really quickly move towards getting past all this?
Okay, Mike said his piece on that question of should companies make you have to, you know, say yes, you are required to take the vaccine. Rosemary, what do you think?
Well, I think that it won't be effective. I mean, if wearing masks sent people into a gun-toting frenzy in some state, imagine what being asked to be stuck with a needle, required to be stuck with a needle, will do. On the other hand, I sort of think that it would just to annoy them. I kind of like that. And I definitely think in schools that should be a consideration, the same way as you don't want your kids exposed to children who have not been inoculated against measles and other potentially deadly diseases. I think that it should be required in some places. Yeah, I think that vaccines are smart. I don't like or trust anti-vaxxers. I think it's just a really anti-community spirit to say it's a matter of independence. It's not. It's not a matter of freedom. So my short answer is yes, do it.
JP?
I actually don't. I kind of agree with what Mike was saying, is that it's hard to believe it would actually come to that people would need to be required. I think that you're going to see widespread adoption early on, especially amongst the elderly. And it's hard to imagine that there's going to be this huge supply of vaccine and that Americans are going to be refusing to take it. You know, over the coming months, we're going to see hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Americans take this vaccine. And I think there's going to continue to be high demand for it. Another thing, too, is, you know, we're targeting people that are over 60 that are going to be able to get the vaccine early. That is, in New York State, that is 85% of the deaths from COVID-19 are from people that are over 60. So if we get a large percentage of our elderly population vaccinated, you're going to see a huge percentage and number of deaths in New York and across the country decrease, assuming that the vaccine is effective and everybody believes that it will be effective 90 to 95%.
Alan?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, Joe. I think everybody should have to take it. I think this is one of those things that we decide as a country will stop this terrible scourge that we're facing. And I know that there will be people who say it's my constitutional right not to take it and all the rest of it. Fine, don't take it. But don't get out on an airplane with me. Don't go to a gym. Don't go do all these other things. And those places have the ability to put an awful lot of pressure on.
Something that, did you ever have, when you have a conversation with somebody and they say something and then it just kind of washes over you, and then 3 hours later you're in the car and it hits you and you're like, oh God, I should have. Dr. Fagan yesterday, Dr. Jim Fagan, who was on our program, was talking about this. And one of the things that came up was that after people get the shot, they won't necessarily have to wear their face mask. So then you have the people who have been inoculated who have not who are not wearing the mask, mixed with people who are just not wearing a mask, and then that becomes very confusing too. Shouldn't just everybody
Joe,
wear a mask?
But, Joe, I don't think Jim Fagan was saying people should not wear masks. I think he truly believes and said that they have to continue to. I think what you're quoting was the belief on some people's parts that they didn't have to wear a mask.
Well, that if someone was not wearing a mask, that it could be perceived that they had not, that they had taken the vaccine.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
There are also the group of people that have had the virus and believe that because of that they are somewhat immune. We don't know for how long. Should they be required to take the vaccine, or should they take the vaccine? Should they be forced to the end of the line for the vaccine? And there are millions of Americans, obviously, that have had the virus and recovered and have antibodies.
Well, the answer is no. Clearly from Fagan yesterday, you know, the idea is that everybody has to get it, even the miscreant who happens to be living at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue is talking about not knowing whether he was going to take it, meaning that's incredible.
Mike?
In the case of mumps, they say that people who have had mumps have a certain level of immunity, but people who take the mumps vaccine have a much higher level of immunity. And that kind of phenomenon goes on with different kinds of things. And they say, to be sure, there is a belief right now that the vaccines give you much greater immunity and longer lasting immunity. And even the Moderna one, that's what the FDA report said today, that it looks like it gives you really powerful immunity. So they're urging people who have had coronavirus and tested positive to still go ahead and get the vaccine, because that way you can be sure of it. And heck, if you had had that disease and that illness, wouldn't you want to keep from getting it again? I mean, why wouldn't you want it again?
And we don't know how long it's going to last, right? Am I correct on that? In other words, the one thing about all of this is we do not know, once you get the shot, how long the protection lasts.
Yeah, that's true. They say that, but they say that, you know, that's something we'll learn. But you know, who knows? Maybe the advice, you know, they do have the right to change the advice when they find out more information. And right now the advice is good advice to just be careful and get the vaccine. I mean, what can it hurt if you've already had the illness? I mean, it'll just give you more protection. At worst, it won't give you any more protection, but why not?
What have you got to lose? Those famous words. James says, I love the idea brought up on the panel of getting celebrities to publicly take the vaccine, but I fear that unless conservative personalities join the cause, there will be a partisan divide, giving vaccines the same fate as masks, something that Rosemary mentioned a moment ago.
This, you know, Joe, that is so interesting. Think about it.
Yeah.
This president, wanted the credit for having developed this vaccine in Operation Warp Speed. Now, a poll this morning shows that minority people and Republicans don't want to take the, in large numbers, don't want to take the vaccine. So here's a president who thought he was going to ride the vaccine to glory and deserve some credit for having pushed it. But think about that for a second, that Republicans seem to be thinking this is some kind of Democratic thing.
Well, you know, I can just see the public service announcement now. Hello, I'm Donald Trump, and I brought you this vaccine. And now I'm going to take it, and I urge you to take it too. You know, a lot of people probably wouldn't take it then.
Have it be branded Trump vaccine.
That would be some SNL skit for sure, Mike. That's good.
Good stuff.
I have a very good friend who said that she would not take the vaccine until Biden was inaugurated. Go figure.
But if the president-elect were to take it soon,
week,
you know, I think that looks good, right?
But there is a political tilt, tension in all of this. There shouldn't be, but there is.
I just worry that also being lost in this is the fact that we hit 300,000. We're at our highest death rate. We're at our highest rate of hospitalizations. The virus is overloading the medical system. And so, yes, there is a light there at the end of the tunnel. But it's still going to be a really long winter, and it's going to be a lot to get, I mean, just I know this is anecdotal, but just here in Albany, you know, there were 1,000 doses, and obviously
Absolutely.
There's a lot of people. We have 1,000 doses. I mean, that's today, but still, it just gives you an idea of how long it is that we have to go. And I think that message has to get out too. And Mike, I don't quite know how you get that out, especially given the waning days of this administration.
Well, everybody has been saying it's going to be a long, dark winter. And, I mean, you know, 2,000, more than 2,000 people a day dying, more than 200,000 testing positive for the disease. I mean, the data doesn't seem to sway people's public opinions. People are fatigued. They want to get together for Christmas. They want this to be over. And yet we just have to hunker down and use our energy to get through this until the vaccine is available for more people. And logically, everything I just said makes sense. Emotionally, I'm just tired of it and I don't want to do it anymore. You know, that's where people are at. It's a tough conundrum.
Mike Spain on the Roundtable panel on Tuesday, December 15th. We'll be back with more Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this short break. Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Roundtable producer Sarah LaDuke. On Friday, December 18th, Alan Shartok and Joe Donahue were joined by the Friday team, former EPA regional administrator, visiting professor at Bennington College, and president of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck, Siena College economics professor Aaron Pasidi, and Albany County District Attorney David Soares.
The stimulus package is taking shape, or so we are told. Although there are some concerns as they close in on a $900 billion stimulus deal, top Democrats and Republicans in Congress haggled on Thursday over a handful of remaining issues that could help determine how much power President-elect Joe Biden will have to act once he takes office to provide additional help for the sputtering economy. Democrats were making a last-ditch effort to provide emergency aid to states, which they argued was critical to helping states weather the pandemic and avoid huge layoffs and cuts in services that could reverberate through the economy. Republicans were working to limit the power of the Federal Reserve to bail out businesses, municipalities, and other institutions in the future. Both disputes could carry heavy consequences for President-elect Biden, who will take office facing a cascade of fiscal crises in states around the country, which will be even more dire if Congress fails to provide at least some assistance right now. And reining in the Fed's lending authority could close off crucial avenues for his administration to stave off more economic havoc. That from the New York Times. Alan, I will go to our economist, Aaron Pasidi, in just a second. But did you want to weigh in before I do?
120 pounds this morning. So, no. I want to hear from Aaron. He's the economist.
All right.
What am I?
Go, Aaron.
So I think the question that most people are asking themselves now is, how can I get me some stimulus? And it looks like we are approaching that. This seems really schizophrenic. And I think a lot of people are kind of scratching their head. Joe, you did a good job highlighting some of the main issues. Yes, there are aspects of the current stimulus proposal that can provide some really important short-term income assistance to unemployed workers, households, and small businesses. But then you hear these crazy things like, you know, limiting the Fed's ability to perform its role as a lender of last resort. So it's going to be very interesting to see what the final bill looks like. You know, since February, 8 million more people in the U.S. have fallen into poverty. 4 million people have dropped out of the labor force, which means they're neither employed or looking for work. The pace of job creation has slowed dramatically over the fall. We're seeing alarming rises in long-term unemployment. We're starting to see unemployment insurance claims ticking up. Retail sales were down 1% during the big shopping month of November. Business closures are accelerating, and the CARES Act is supposed to – well, the CARES Act is lapsing at the end of December. So it's really difficult to wrap your head around why there wasn't a stimulus bill that came out in July and then another one in the fall. There are serious short-term problems that the economy is facing, and it creates real financial hardship for a lot of families. Making decisions about paying the rent versus buying groceries, whether to stay home and care for your children since they're not, you know, in school in person, or keep your job. These are not questions that people living in, you know, the world's wealthiest economy ever should be facing. I think it's important to point out that a lot of these conditions, the slow creep of poverty, diminished job opportunities, rising inequality, those are not new. They've been around for, you know, 40 years, really since the election of Ronald Reagan. So this financial fragility has existed in the country for decades, and the pandemic has really laid that insecurity bare. So there is an opportunity to take advantage of this crisis, being able to see all of the hardship that people are facing, and hopefully start forging a new, more equitable economy that works for everyone. But this, and the stimulus bill is not going to do that. The current $900 billion proposal is really and almost exclusively focused on very short-term aid to households and small businesses. Mm. So, you know, what we're seeing is the $600 stimulus checks, meaning just a straight-up $600 check that is mailed from the Treasury Department to households. I was unable to find any information about the eligibility requirements. Like, the $1,200 check in March was on a sliding scale, I think up until like $100,000 of income. So that's not finalized yet, but it looks like $600 will be the amount, even though President Trump was suggesting a $2,000 check, which honestly is a very good idea. People should be getting more money. There's a $300 weekly unemployment insurance subsidy that would last 10 weeks for unemployed workers, providing a really important income boost that can help workers bridge the gap between two jobs. Extending the payroll protection program, which was grants and loans to small businesses, incentivizing them to keep workers on the payroll. Providing rental assistance to families and increasing the funding for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, so food assistance, and then some vaccine distribution. So that's those are the big components. And in its current form, with its current funding, you're looking at maybe about, you know, a month and a half or 2 months worth of support before another stimulus bill is needed. So, you know, in that sense, it helps, you know, any help that, you know, struggling households and businesses can get that helps them get through what is likely to be a pretty rough winter, both in terms of economics and public health. What's been left out of the stimulus bill, I think, is a bigger story and more concern to economists and policymakers. So Republicans were pushing for the litigation protection for businesses who are facing lawsuits about COVID. That's not a stimulus. That is absolute pork and favorable treatment of a variety of businesses. The big sticking point and the least sexy and exciting thing to discuss is state and local government finances. All states, with the exception of North Dakota and Wyoming, have a balanced budget requirement. So what that means is that states every year have to submit and strive to make sure that the amount they spend is equal to the tax revenue they get. When a large recession hits, tax revenue for states drops. People are spending less, so there's less sales tax. People aren't moving as much and upsizing their properties, so property tax revenue can stay flat. Workers who lose their job aren't paying state income taxes. States face a huge revenue shortfall just mechanically when a recession hits. And since they have a balanced budget amendment, there are two ways a state can achieve a balanced budget. One is to increase taxes, which is politically unpopular and also suicidal during a recession. So what they normally do is decrease their spending on public services like, you know, things like snow plowing and trash pickup, or they can lay off state and local government employees. State and local government employment makes up about 10% of all employment in the U.S. So when state and local governments, you know, nationwide have to shed jobs to keep their budgets balanced, you know, that's a huge hit to employment. So you have more workers who are jobless. That means there's less spending. And all that does is exacerbate and, you know, drag the economy further down or slow the economy's growth coming back into an expansion. The decline in state and local government employment was one of the major reasons that the recovery from the recession in 2008 and 2009 was so painfully long. It is really important that the Biden administration take up some type of state and local government aid. Hopefully, Democrats will have control of Congress, and that won't be an issue. But how to achieve that with a divided Congress is going to be very challenging.
But, Aaron, what about raising taxes? Now we have a speaker, majority leader in the state Senate, who want to raise taxes and say, let the rich pay it. What about that?
Excellent point, Alan. As long as tax increases are progressive, meaning the tax increases fall on people who have exceptionally high incomes, that is a perfectly equitable way to prevent layoffs and to help increase state tax revenue. The issue is, you know, those are the same people who are also contributing to a lot of these political campaigns, so it becomes politically tricky. But yeah, tax increases on, you know, the very wealthy is a perfectly acceptable and economically justifiable way to bridge the budget shortfall. So it'll be interesting to see if that happens. My guess is probably not. The biggest risk the economy faces right now, and then I'll be quiet, is that this stimulus is way too small. An extra $600 for households might help them for a month. The $300 unemployment insurance subsidy will make lives a little bit easier for unemployed workers for 10 weeks. This is very, very thin. And what's going to happen is it's entirely likely that when the economy does start recovering, we experience what's called a K-shaped recovery. So if you imagine the letter K, where on the right-hand side, you've got a line that's going up and a line that's going down.
Yeah.
You know, for workers who have not been affected by the pandemic, who are able to work remotely, who are experiencing, you know, increases in business and increases in their salary, they're going to be doing fine. But then there's going to be this other much larger segment of the economy who are, you know, still struggling against persistent job insecurity, persistent financial insecurity, who are, you know, dealing with long-term unemployment. It's really important to focus on the bottom half of that K for the incoming Biden administration. And that means more than getting us through, you know, the period until everybody's vaccinated and life returns to normal. We need to be thinking about providing economic opportunity, you know, for the next couple of decades.
David Soares.
Yeah, it's just, this is just fascinating. I mean, to watch, just to watch the American people all across our country struggle in ways that we're struggling right now. It's almost like you're watching, you know, communist Poland when you're seeing the line of people at food banks right now, all because of COVID. But Aaron is absolutely right. And by the way, it's Aaron Pacetti and not Aaron Brissetti. But you're absolutely right. This has been with us historically, but now it's just exponentially worse. what I continue to find remarkable, and I shouldn't be surprised, but I still am in some ways, is that Republicans we've watched over the last decade, several decades, abandon science in an effort to continue to prop up corporations like tobacco, the tobacco industry. In order for you to continue to prop up the tobacco industry, you must deny the science. In order for you to deny to continue to prop up the gas and oil industry, you have to deny the science as it relates to the environment. But now, you know, the fiscal hawks have abandoned economics. It just doesn't make any sense whatsoever at a time that we're experiencing the worst pandemic in our country that is affecting every facet of our society, putting our economy, our larger economy, in jeopardy, that we're here having discussions and negotiating over whether we're going to provide protections for lawsuits and other litigation for corporations, or whether we're going to provide money so that states can plow and states can continue to have fire and police. And what's worse, I think the salt in the wound is this effort that's going on right now by Mitch McConnell, trying to limit the Fed and its ability to lend, because they know that once this new administration comes in, then that's exactly where we're going. We have to provide resources for the states. And so my question to Aaron, and I think Aaron's more than qualified to answer this question, is when are Democrats going to stop playing this game with the Republicans in the Senate, where we abide by the Marx of Queensberry rules, and they just continue to pull out foreign objects? And here's my question. What if the Democrats were to propose the creation of a formula that distributes federal dollars in aid based upon what individual states contribute to the federal government? Because, you see, where we are right now are red states that continue to hold back on this aid because it's a blue state bailout, except that we know that blue states contribute more to the federal government. Aaron, what would that look like in your mind if Democrats were to propose such a thing?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Democrats tend to be concentrated in the wealthier areas of the country, and that includes wealthier states. And wealthier states contribute more in tax revenue to the federal government and receive less in government payments. So, yeah, blue states have been subsidizing red states, you know, forever. To have some type of, you know, in any other advanced economy that has a federalist system like the United States does, this would be fairly straightforward. There's a formula. States receive aid when they are struggling based, in large part on the size of their economy and their needs. So larger states with wealthier people will experience larger budget shortfalls when a recession hits because there's more income lost than lower income red states. The point is that kind of, you know, forgoes the whole, it's a good idea, but it's also not progressive in that, you know, the wealthier states help subsidize the less wealthy states. So you can make an argument that it's not equitable or fair to the red states. But there needs to be some type of structural approach in dealing with state and local government finances, because, you know, two of the three recessions in the 21st century have absolutely devastated state and local government employment. And all it does is create more economic hardship that's stretched out over a longer and longer period.
Aaron Pacitti on the Roundtable panel on Friday, December 18th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. You may contact us by emailing roundtable@wamc.org. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke.
How can I get me some stimulus?